Well, that song couldn't be more perfect, not just because we're talking about racing toward Armageddon coming up with Michael Bajant, but also because of what happened to my blog tonight. I put it up at coasttocoastam.com, and I don't know what it is lately about this server that I'm working with. It seems to get all strange, and just like that song by REM, my blog is turned into one giant run-on sentence. There's no punctuation. Well, at least almost no punctuation. It just completely compressed the blog into one paragraph. So it's crazy. I'm just warning you. There's nothing I could do about it. It's Labor Day weekend. I'm not going to be able to get anybody on it. So I'm sorry about that. But you can read it. It all makes sense. It sounds like it looks like rap. It looks like just one big giant rap. You can take a look online at coasttocoastam.com. You'll see what I'm talking about. And if you missed crypto news last hour, it's all in there somewhere. It's just you have to imagine the breaks, and there's no italics and whatever. All right. So thank you all too for being here on Labor Day weekend. And I hope that if you're hearing the show live, and you know of somebody who is a Michael Bajant fan who just may not be up and around, or they're on vacation or something like that, let them know about this show so they can go back and listen to it on the podcast and catch it on Streamlink. I think this is a really important show, and we'll talk about why, as well as the news story today that comes out of Jerusalem that reaffirms the work of Michael Bajant on racing toward Armageddon, the three great religions and the plot to end the world, and why it's so important for us to be mindful about it right now on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Michael Bajant joins us live on Coast to Coast AM. Thank you, Michael Bajant, for joining us on a Labor Day weekend, although I suppose it's not a Labor Day weekend for you.
I have no idea what it is. You're just quite early.
Well, see, for us it's a holiday, so thank you, and I'm glad that that you're going to be with us. Originally from New Zealand, of course, most people know Michael Bajant from Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the other book that he co-wrote with Henry Lincoln and Richard Lee, The Messianic Legacy. But he's also the co-author of The Temples and the Lodge, Dead Sea Scrolls, Deception. What about 15 other books? Am I in the ballpark? 20 other books, Michael?
Well, if you include a couple that came out in Germany, there's 14 so far.
Okay, very good. And I thought of you today with this story that was in CNN, and I'll get back to that in just a second about the wall. But when we're talking about Holy Blood, Holy Grail, can't help but ask you, because of how what a big impact that book has had, and I think it was an entertaining book to read, and it had some really great, pot stirring information in there that that you are famous for. Is there anything about Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the effect that it's had that you have any regrets about? Is there anything that, like, where you look back and you think, well, people are taking this part too seriously, or they should really read the book?
Well, I think your last statement pertains really to every book I've written because they're all packed with information. And, some information is more crucial than other information. But my main attitude towards Holy Blood is one of astonishment. We wrote it, it appeared, it did very well, but it's just kept on selling, and whole new generations of younger people have discovered it. I'm constantly, my mouth drops at the reach that it's had and
Right.
the influence that it's had. But we didn't sort of sit down to write it. In a funny way, the story sort of told itself through us. We just happened to be there, and we just happened to pick it up. But there was a kind of, it was like a gift that was given to us, and whether we did it well or badly is, our problem, but the story was there, and it needed to be told.
Well, I think you did it very well. I think if I could offer an observation, it's as an early reader of the book, I thought what sometimes what I get frustrated with is that there was a lot of really good speculation in Holy Blood, Holy Grail. You guys were all putting pieces together, and you were saying, you know, what if, and it could be this, and boy, it sure looks like that. But over time, sometimes that has gotten limited to it's a fact that this is exactly how it happened. And I don't think that does justice to your book.
That's a real problem. I mean, we have tried in our books to be very clear when we've got facts and very clear when we're speculating, because people do confuse it. It's very easy to do. And, I mean, one of the problems with history, of course, is that history is basically speculation, because we weren't standing there at the event. We don't really know what happened. And one of the problems with history is that a kind of consensus comes together, and people agree that this is the way it was. And if new information comes along, they fight tooth and nail to keep that information excluded, because people have too much of their career or too much ego or whatever involved with their particular reconstruction. And what I try to do, what my colleagues and I tried to do, is simply look at all the data and decide whether the existing hypothesis or the existing reconstruction, whatever you want to call it, matches or stands up. And in many cases, we found that it didn't, and that we had to try and think of a way of revising it to take account of this data. But basically, I'm in the business of asking questions.
Right.
You know, my feeling is that if you ask questions, you already have an inkling that there's something askew. And for me, the posing of questions is one of the most important things we can do as human beings.
And it's what you do so well. And as I said, you're as much of a pot stirrer as you are, a great author. You propose these things, and you push readers to think outside of whatever their comfort zone might have been. I just think it's interesting that Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, has created its own kind of new orthodoxy, where people are convinced, 100% convinced, that this is now the new set of facts. And I think, gosh, that wasn't the cool part of the book. The cool part of the book was, what if? And look, what if we look at it from this point of view? Instead, it's become something now which some people are almost incorporating into kind of new age religious orthodoxy. You know what I'm saying?
People love certainty. And unfortunately, the posing of hypotheses and questions is rather open-ended, and so they tend to chop that open end off or block it up with a lump of concrete and decide that that's all they need to know, and it's true. It's a constant danger, and that's where our education systems should be teaching us the whole point of asking questions, posing hypotheses, testing the hypotheses. That's the way we progress.
I can't help but think, as somebody who's studied this a little bit myself, that there weren't, if some of the New Testament writers, just to use an example, were with us today and they saw how some of what they wrote in a letter, a fragment of a letter that might have been copied 15 times before it ended up in the Bible, that what they might say about how what they wrote has become interpreted and set, to use your term in that same way, in stone, when they were writing something just to try to encourage and do whatever, and it kind of gets twisted around. And in a way, you're kind of, at least from where I sit, it seems like that's sort of happening even in your lifetime, as people are taking Holy Blood, Holy Grail and making it part of a new set of in-stone religious beliefs. And I think, gosh, it's so interesting to see that happen in real time.
If I was younger, perhaps I could do a PhD on that.
Yeah, very good. Well, and you could do a PhD. You certainly have the educational background for it. And Michael Bagent, now the author of Racing Toward Armageddon, The Three Great Religions and the Plot to End the World. In this case, I would say you're doing less speculation than you're doing in other books. In fact, I think in Racing Toward Armageddon, you are fairly well seated within kind of a good journalistic zone of verifiable information.
Well, I was sort of running on outrage with this one, because there was just events happening in the world that weren't seem to be picked up by mainstream media, or if they were, it was picked up, noted, dismissed. And I ran into the story in the early 1990s, and I quite often tried to get journalists interested in pursuing it, because I was working on other projects, but this thing just really burned away at me. I just couldn't get any of them interested, and so in the end, I decided, well, I better write it myself.
So, what were you saying to journalists? What were you saying to them in the early '90s? What was getting to you back then that you were saying you really should write about this story? What was the story that you saw back
the
then?
The red heifer.
Yeah, that is sort of at the nexus of a lot of this, isn't it?
I mean, the story of the red heifer is just the most outrageous and bizarre event. The fact that they're trying to breed a red heifer to produce what is the most efficacious purifying medium known to Judaism. Once they've got this, they slaughter the heifer, they burn it, they mix it with spring water. They can then storm the temple in Jerusalem, throwing this water before them and thus purifying the ground on which they stand. They can invade the temple area, destroy the Muslim mosques, and start rebuilding the temple. Now, at that point, the mainstream media would probably get involved and understand that something weird had just happened, and the implications don't even bear thinking about.
But in this case, when you say they in your account, you mean sort of extreme Orthodox Jews who are anxious to tear down the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. They want to tear down, they want to take the mosque off there, rebuild the temple, and that the part of the they includes extreme, it would seem, fundamentalist Christians that are trying to raise the perfect red heifer to give it to them for them to slaughter so that they will go in and they will start what would certainly be a holy war.
And it gets worse, because when the temple is rebuilt, the Jewish fundamentalists, and many of whom I would call extremists, say that the Messiah is going to appear. The Christian fundamentalists, many of whom I would also call extremists, believe that when the temple is built, also that the Messiah will return. But the two messiahs are completely different people. The Christian fundamentalists think that their Messiah is going to convert all the Jews to Christianity. And it gets even worse than that, because the Islamic groups have exactly the same idea. Their Messiah, the Mahdi, is going to return, come to Jerusalem with Jesus, oddly enough, and convert the whole world to Islam, with the exception of the Jews, of course, who they're going to slaughter without mercy. So we've suddenly got these three Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all with this fundamentalist, extremist core, which is gaining the levers of power within the religions and having a lot of influence, all believing that there's going to be an end of the world with the return of the Messiah, and it's all going to be based in Jerusalem. One can only say, poor Jerusalem, what did it ever do to deserve this?
Well, and the Red Heifer Project, on the face of it, I remember seeing news stories at the time about it, and it seemed a little more innocuous when it was originally presented in the story that I saw, that it was about having, well, you know, it wasn't quite a kumbaya moment, but it sort of seemed like it a little bit, where here were these Christians in, was it Mississippi? Is that where the farmer's from that was raising?
Yeah, Mississippi and Louisiana originally,
right.
Yes.
And they were trying to raise the red heifer, the perfect red heifer. Explain what the heifer has to be like, if you would.
Well, it has to be red, and after 3 years, it's not allowed to have any imperfection. And in fact, in the mid-90s, they did produce a red heifer. By this stage, the breeding program had moved to Israel, and they produced one who they named Melody. After a couple of years, in fact, some imperfections arose, so Melody obviously wasn't any good. But the programs continued, but it's gone very quiet. I think because of various bits and pieces of publicity over the years, especially in Israel, that they realize that a lot of people are very worried about it. I mean, some Israeli journalists were calling for the slaughter of all the red heifers because they could see it was only going to cause trouble. So they're doing it a bit more clandestinely. And also, of course, the accord between the Christian fundamentalists and the Jewish fundamentalists has more or less broken down, because one of the major Christian breeders, Reverend Clyde Lott, was suddenly discovered to be proclaiming to his Christian audience that he was spreading the word of the gospel in Israel. And of course, the fundamentalist Jewish rabbis he was dealing with thought that was anathema.
Right.
And it basically fell to pieces, because this is the problem. The Israeli fundamentalists are accepting money from Christian fundamentalists to sponsor a lot of their programs, but they're ignoring the fact that the Christians think that all of Israel, all of the Jews, will be converted to Christianity, which, of course, is just not on the radar of the fundamentalist Jews behind this. And so there is a real problem there, which both sides tend to play down, and they just quietly don't talk about certain aspects.
Well, that's why that story at the time, when I originally saw it in the media, seemed to indicate, well, isn't this nice? They're working together and they're trying to, but really underneath it, the undercurrent of these fundamentalist extremists trying to come up with the perfect red heifer to give to the other fundamentalist Jews so that they could create this march on the Dome of the Rock. There was a darkness to this. It was about actually bringing about the destruction of the world as we know it. And that brings us back to what the Muslim expectation is, because you mentioned it briefly, but it might have confused people when you said the Mahdi, the salvific force at the end of the world for radical Islam, would come back with Jesus. So explain that, because that would be, for some people, they'd be thinking, oh, see, now we can all get together on the Jesus thing.
Well, Jesus is one of the holy figures in the Quran, but the Muslims, of course, don't believe that Jesus is in any way divine, but they still revere him as a prophet. But the Mahdi, who's the Messiah figure in Islam, who fights against the Dajjal, which is the Antichrist figure in Islam, the Mahdi, after this huge battle, which pretty much equates with the Christian idea of Armageddon, will come back to Jerusalem. And there's a very early Muslim story, a hadith from about the 9th century, where the Mahdi says to Jesus, you know, preach to all the people, and Jesus says nothing but pushes the Mahdi forward so that he can preach. And what that's saying is that the Mahdi is actually more important than Jesus.
And we often hear about the vision of radical Islam to convert the world to all of the Muslim belief, to bring us into the Muslim fold, and we see that in the jihadic activities of Al-Qaeda and others. Certainly 9/11 seemed part of that. The idea that they're going to create a holy war and overcome the forces that are against Islam. That is a this worldly thing. But it's this otherworldly aspect of Armageddon, which is really, I think, the part that's terrifying. The belief that if there could be a nuclear holocaust in some people's minds, that will be a good thing. And that's kind of where we'll leave it here, if you would. We'll come back with Michael Bajant, Racing Toward Armageddon, The Three Great Religions and the Plot to End the World. And I want to tie into that coming up this story that appeared in the last 24 hours about a mysterious wall in Jerusalem. And mysterious for a couple of reasons, all of them very cool and relevant to what we're talking about. Again, it's not just Christianity, it's not just Judaism, it's not just Islam we're talking about, but rather the extreme versions of these. And we'll talk more about how many of them are kind of working together to create this Armageddon and what Armageddon would look like. We'll start with the Muslim Armageddon. What about what is it about this particular valley of Megiddo, and why and how will this battle take place? We'll give you descriptions of that, and really looking forward to this interview. We've got to stop this from happening because some people insist that it should happen, and tomorrow is too late. We'll get to that coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Michael Bajan's Racing Toward Armageddon, the book which he said he wrote with a kind of outrage in mind, mostly because he was trying to get other people to do the work on it, but they wouldn't. If you got to do something right, you got to do it yourself. And so he has tracked the story, and he's showing, if you looked at it on graph paper, the trajectory of extremist beliefs, how they're all leading back to Jerusalem. Why? And what could happen in our lifetimes with these extremist groups if just the right amount of funding happens, if just a few news stories go left as opposed to right, how it could all come together for catastrophic results and what we could do about it coming up next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Michael Bajan, who's probably best known for being the co-author of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, but who's been writing now for decades and focused on the same thing, alternative views of religious history, different ways of sort of understanding the same news stories that we're all experiencing, like Racing Toward Armageddon. And in this case, we're talking about extreme Islam, extreme Judaism, and extreme Christianity. We're probably most familiar with fundamentalist Christianity, even extreme fundamentalist Christianity in this country. Talk more about what extreme Judaism looks like, as you understand it, and extreme Islam.
Well, Judaism, first thing we have to say really is that it doesn't have a tradition of a battle of Armageddon, whereas Christianity and Islam do have this tradition of a great battle. But nevertheless, it's hard to see how fundamentalist Judaism could fulfill its aims without considerable fighting. Basically, they want a theocracy, that is, a state where the only laws are the laws as written down in the Bible. And they want that in Israel. They want to get rid of the Muslim structures on the Temple Mount. They want to rebuild the temple. And their vision is that Jerusalem will be the spiritual capital of the world, and that the Jewish nation will, in a sense, be the conduit for the redemption of the world, that it will be the most spiritual nation around, and through the Jewish nation, the rest of the world will be led towards spirituality. So to that extent, in a sense, it wants to see the whole world as Judaic. Islam is rather more violent, but it has the same aim. It wants to set up a worldwide caliphate run from Jerusalem, and it wants to convert the entire world to Islam. It wants to take over all the technology invented by the West, because one of the things the Muslim fundamentalists can't understand is that if they're the chosen of God, why is it that they're more or less irrelevant in the modern world? Why haven't they got the technology? Why haven't they got the power? And this conundrum seems insoluble to them, because, of course, the reason they haven't got those things is because they don't have the freedom of thought, the freedom of research, the freedom of expression, which has produced all the technology that we enjoy in the West. But they think that it just should be given to them by right.
And yet a lot of the fundamentalist Christian beliefs in a coming battle in Armageddon or in Megiddo, in this valley of Megiddo, that a lot of those are Judaic beliefs reinterpreted through the New Testament lens.
What's happened is that it's basically all down to the book of Revelation, which John wrote in the island of Patmos while he was in exile there. And it's incredibly symbolic. And one could argue, and many do, and I happen to think they're probably closer to the truth, that the point of revelation is a symbolic expression of internal moral battles. But if we take it at face value, as the fundamentalists do, and see it as a prediction of the future, one thing becomes very clear, and that is that it's drawing from all the Old Testament texts, particularly from Daniel, from Ezekiel, the kind of symbolism, the creatures or the monsters with multiple wings and multiple heads can all be found in the Old Testament. So John was obviously, even though a Christian, was obviously well-versed in Jewish traditions. He was probably a convert, I should say, because he also expected that his audience would understand a lot of quite subtle allusions that he makes during the course of the book. And you would only understand these if you'd been raised in an apocalyptic and messianic Jewish context.
Right.
The sort of context, for example, that we find with the Dead Sea Scrolls, which there's certain parallels between, say, the War Scroll and the Book of Revelation. And I think it's pretty clear that John at least knew of the messianic Dead Sea Scroll literature. Probably had read it.
Well, and that the symbolism on which he drew was based around the idea of an uprising against Rome. He uses the Babylonian metaphor, but as you go into the book in great detail and Racing Toward Armageddon, you know, it's pretty easy to sort of track a lot of where John was coming from. But what's less certain is how it is that this is being interpreted for modern times. We can see the Judaic roots of the symbolism. We can see the Old Testament, the Christian Old Testament scripture references and how they get slightly rephrased. But what we don't always see are two things. We don't see whether or not this was projected forward into the future, which some people believe this was all about predicting events here in the new millennium. But then also whether or not John was influenced by, and I thought this particular part of what you wrote was really interesting, was about Pompeii. And how much about the events of the explosion of Mount Vesuvius influenced John of Patmos. Can you talk about both of those things?
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that John wasn't predicting the far future. He was predicting what was going to happen tomorrow or next year. He actually states in Revelation that some of the witnesses of the Battle of Armageddon will be those who also witnessed the crucifixion of Jesus. And he was writing around about probably 95 AD, during the last part of Domitian's reign. Now, to say that shows the limits of his predictions, for example. He had no concept of it being relevant to 1,000 or 2,000 years forward. And another thing that's interesting that you noted, that when you read through Revelation, there's certain aspects that are not only drawing from Old Testament texts, but there's some which seems to be drawing from contemporary events. It seems very likely that John was well aware of contemporary events. And this business with Pompeii is interesting because he's got a section in Revelation where he's talking about the destruction of Rome, but he talks about the sailors, the seafarers and their ships setting off, staying away from the land because the sea had fire pouring into it. And there was obviously, it's a description of an eruption. And it struck me that this is kind of sailor's talk. It's the kind of thing you would hear if you went down to the wharves and chatted to eyewitnesses. And remember that Pompeii was, 79 AD, which is only about 10 or 15 years before John was writing. And so I think it would have been a very raw experience. And secondly, even the pagans at the time were pondering whether the destruction of Pompeii was because some way or another Pompeii had deserved the enmity of the gods and that the gods were wiping out Pompeii. And this idea of divine retribution being visited upon the city is precisely the idea that John has woven into Revelation. And I can't see it in any other way but that John was influenced by these events.
Well, and it would intriguing, actually, were some of the very specific language that John of Patmos uses in Revelation and how it seems to echo the historical record, the non-Christian historical record of the time of Pliny the Younger, right? He was the one that survived?
Yes. Pliny the Younger saw his uncle, who's called Pliny the Elder, die on the beaches of Pompeii. And he was, there's a lovely description by Pliny where he talks of being on his ship, looking across the sea with all the pumice falling and the sea being blocked up. And it's very similar to a description in Revelation. And again, it's either sailor's talk or perhaps John had actually read Pliny's account. I mean, we obviously can't know his source. But the parallels are very striking and I think relevant.
Well, I want to read that coming up here in just a second. I think that's really important to point out because it is a recurring theme about watching the destruction of the world, as it were, from boats, watching it from offshore, and how that it seems very much like what we would say today if we were to use the term today, that John of Patmos was preaching with scripture in one hand and a newspaper in the other. He was doing what prophetic preachers do to this day, which is to make scripture relevant. And it's very much like what a lot of people are doing when they try to say that the news events of today help us understand the book of Revelation, and that at any time now, the sort of constellation of world events is going to come together and it's going to form the perfect cauldron in which the end times will begin. Some people believe that's already happened with the formation of the European Union. Can you address that, the idea of the European Union as being how the planets are lining up to create Armageddon?
Don't get me started on the European Union.
That's why you're here.
It's a travesty. Democracy has just about vanished here in Europe. The European Union is this great monster which is run by a junta, which is called a commission, which no one votes for. It's totally undemocratic, and yet most of our laws come from this source. But the European Union gets a particular mention in modern fundamentalist interpretations of Revelation, because in Revelation there's this great beast with 10 heads, and the idea is that each of the heads is one of the countries of the European Union, and this is going to be fighting for the Antichrist and against the forces of Jesus and God. Therefore, this monster is to be wiped out. Therefore, the European Union is to be wiped out. And there's a lot of speculation in fundamentalist literature about a war between the United States fielding the forces of God and the forces and Europe, which is being fielded or being led by the Antichrist. And once, many years ago, when I first got interested in this was the early 80s, actually, I went along to the U.S. military headquarters, who were serving in NATO, but it was the U.S. headquarters. And I talked to the head chaplain there because I was worried that what would happen, was my question, if someone who believed there was going to be a battle against Europe, was serving in the U.S. forces in Europe. Was there some kind of psychological problem that these people would perhaps come up with? And I had quite an interesting talk with the chaplain and his advisors who claimed that they were journalists, but nothing really was resolved. But right at the end, just as I was leaving, he sort of quietly said to me, you know, the people we're really worried about in the forces is the Christian Broadcasting Network. And I thought that was very revealing because this, as I'm sure most Americans know, is a hugely funded and hugely extended broadcasting network all through the world, which is pumping out this kind of information. And I felt that that was a real admission, that they were worried about this prophecy of a war between America and Europe. And you see, it's like Armageddon. If you believe something, it affects your behavior. And the fear that's running through my book is how much of this belief could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Something like 59% of Americans, according to a poll of 2004, believe that the Battle of Armageddon is coming, which means if the U.S. armed forces are representative, probably 59% of the armed forces believe this. If you're serving in the Middle East and you believe that the battles you're fighting are sort of preliminaries to the Battle of Armageddon, how is that going to affect your behavior? And the only answer we can say is, well, negatively, because at the end of the day, if you're sent by the politicians to fight in a country, you should be fighting for the values of your country, not for some religious or ideological purpose of that sort.
Well, okay, I think that's a really interesting thing to unpack, but I also... if you'll pardon me, I think in a way that's kind of a sidebar, because I think what's really crucial to point out is that the European, if we're talking about a battle between America and the European Union, that does not really seem to follow the prophecy of the Book of Revelation, that there are very specific things in the Book of Revelation that says they're going to happen. And a battle between the United States and the EU doesn't seem to be it.
Well, no, I quite agree. That right. this is some of the speculation that's coming out. I mean, basically, the people who are going to be involved in Europe, according to the gamut of speculation, are the Muslims. The Muslims are going to invade and convert all of Europe to Islam. And so the European armies are going to help the Muslim Messiah in the attack against the Jews in Jerusalem, and by Jews, they also mean the United States. They sort of conflated the two. And it's useful to understand that the Muslim fundamentalist attitude is that every single Jew will be annihilated without mercy. And we find this in the charter, the 1988 charter of Hamas. And Hamas specifically states that they agree with this promise of Allah to wipe out the Jews prior to the taking of Jerusalem. So we can see that this is not just idle philosophical apocalyptic thought. This is real, and this is going to create piles of bodies. And but it's something that we need to avoid at all costs.
If we're talking about real, we have to point out that, in fact, the European Union is not a group of 10 countries that would seem to fit the Book of Revelation model. It's, in fact, as of last count, 27?
27, yeah, and there's a few more wanting to join.
And a few more wanting to join. So how could that in any way fulfill the prophecy of the 10-headed beast? If it said a 31-headed beast and we were still going toward that, that'd be one thing, but it doesn't seem to be going that way.
Yeah, well, the fundamentalists are not very good on history. Which makes it easier for them to push out these particular concepts.
And so, again, we're talking about how all of this would take place in and around Jerusalem. And so I want to get into that, too, coming up, because I keep teasing the story. Then we end up getting sidetracked and I never get back to it. And I want to talk about this wall that they discovered in Jerusalem recently and what I think that has to say about where we stand. And then if you could, I'd ask you, Michael Bajan, coming up in the next hour, to tell the narrative as you understand it from the Book of Revelation of what will happen, and then how that relates to 200 million Chinese that would be involved in this battle. That is a popular figure, and that is a popular country for people to say will actually be the invading horde. 200 million Chinese. Next, Racing Toward Armageddon, the three great religions and the plot to end the world. It's really the extreme ends of three groups who are all focusing on the same place. and how this intersection coming up could spell disaster in our lifetime, and what we need to do to stop it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.